but I don't really touch on menageries, so I'm asking you all to just ignore that and maybe replace it with something else. Okay.
So I'm going to start with a kind of fairly quick and dirty reading of a passage from an essay that would be very familiar to many of us, probably all of us, which is the John Virgin essay on Why Look at Owls? But which I hope in this paper to invest with new significance by reading it through a video game. This passage explores the role zoo animals play as kind of empty mementos of what Berger styles the formative exchange of animal and human gazes. He says the public purpose of zoos is to offer visitors the opportunity of looking at animals. Yet nowhere in a zoo can a stranger encounter the look of an animal. At the most, the animal's gaze flickers and passes on. They look sideways. They look blindly beyond. They scan mechanically. They have been immunized to encounter because nothing can anymore occupy a central place in their attention. The Burgess rather anthropocentric argument is that such encounters were once a crucial enabler of human cognitive development. Animals, as encountered by our distant ancestors, were relatable, recognisable, yet separated from us by a narrow abyss of non-comprehension. And that unsettling duality lies at the root of our ability to make distinctions. Here is a creature we can relate to, a creature whose look we recognise, but which nonetheless holds us at a distance in the act of returning our look, which does not share a language with us, and which thus has secrets we can never discover. Berger goes on that under the corrosive regime of modern capitalism, however, animals aren't always the observed. The fact that they can observe us has lost all significance. They are the objects of our ever-extending knowledge. What we know about them is an index of our power, and thus an index of what separates us from them. The more we know, the further away they are. Now, you could argue that this distancing is most extreme in the factory farm, where non-human animals are manufactured and dismantled by the billion in ferocious secrecy. But it's perhaps more damning in the zoo, where the creature's liveliness is emphasised even as it is reduced to spectacle. Animals in zoos, Burgess says, are a monument to the impossibility of human-animal encounters. Their inhabitants are produced by human activity, they have no significant autonomy, are emptied of secrets, and so often offer the human observer no purchase for reflection. Berger writes that the animals, isolated from each other and without interaction between species, become utterly dependent upon their keepers. Consequently, most of their responses have been changed. What was central to their interest has been replaced by passive waiting for a series of arbitrary outside interventions. This is a creature known as the Tobi Kagachi, which roughly translates in Japanese to flying snake. And I met it during exploration of an area in the video game Monster Hunter World, the 14th installment in the popular Monster Hunter series from Capcom, which is a fairly well-known video game publisher based in Osaka, Japan. I'm going to dig into the detail of what you actually do in Monster Hunter shortly, but the title is obviously fairly self-explanatory. This is a game in which you control an avatar from a third-person perspective in order to track down and slaughter giant creatures which are loosely inspired by dinosaurs, European and Japanese folklore traditions, and currently existing or recently extinct giant predators. Each hunt typically involves a thrilling clash with your quarry, in which you must pit kind of arcane weapons, these massive over-designed axes and swords and traps, and various kind of consumable items coming against biological defences such as flame breath, or in this case bioelectrical quills, as these kind of electric barbs at the back. In this case though, I was disappointed because when I tracked down this creature and presented myself boldly before it, I was ignored. Now, this was a technical problem. I mean, to offer a very rudimentary technical insight on the game, each monster's artificial intelligence is capable of state changes. By default, it wanders the environment according to variables such as a desire to thirst or prey, interacting with the landscape and other creatures in passing. If it hears or smells the player's avatar, smells, hears, I mean, obviously this is not literally the case, it will become suspicious and stop what it's doing and maybe start looking behind it or kind of scenting the air in this very theatrical way. And if it actually sees you, it will of course kind of escalate into a state of aggression. And then if it is wounded, it will try to retreat to a lair to rest and lick its wounds. In this case, what appears to have happened is that the creature got stuck between passive and suspicious states. When I approached it, it would do the whole sort of smelling the air thing. It would never escalate into full aggression, and eventually it would just return to its default state. Now, this allowed a couple of things. Firstly, it meant I could follow the creature as if I wasn't there and see what it got up to in the absence of a player. This is important This is important because as the Monster Hunter, well, because the Monster Hunter series has always prided itself on the fact that the animals it depicts do have a certain agency independent of human observation. There are many such games with kind of large 3D wilderness landscapes in which you slay great beasts, but they seldom simulate creaturely behaviour that is not directly appreciable by the player. An example, if you're familiar with games, would be Far Cry. After all, the developer has limited computational resources to play with, so simulating animal behaviour when they're out of view is not, you know, resource efficient. Monster Hunter, by contrast, styles itself a game in which creatures actively inhabit landscapes when out of view. They utilise them for their own benefit, rather than, in Burgess' phrase, passively waiting for a series of arbitrary outside interventions. So being able to shadow this monster was interesting, but it only kind of revealed the poverty of the creature's habits and routines. When out of view, it was essentially a glorified fairground prop. It was trundling from parts of the world to the other parts of the world, according to a very narrow set of behavioural criteria, essentially feeding, sleeping, and prowling, and there were very obviously kind of timers that were dictating its motions. And you could say that its motions were not really its own at all, but those of the environment, the motions made possible by those unseen timers, and by different terrain contexts, such as the difference between foraging spots, lairs, and shortcuts, the kind of underground routes and things, and kind of clearings, which are laid out expressly for the purposes of giving you a place to do battle. So the second outcome of this technical error was to effect a sort of parody of Cartesian division between what you might call the creature's body and its mind or animating spirit. As I said, the animal's AI treated me overall as if I wasn't present, but there are many layers of creaturely expression and response in Monster Hunter. In this case, the creature's body was governed by a separate set of context-sensitive programming routines, which caused it to automatically turn its head towards me whenever I came close. Thus, it couldn't see me, but it couldn't stop looking at me. I mean, as Berger might say, it could only look sideways, scan mechanically. There was no way in which to encounter its look. Now, Berger is writing about flesh and blood creatures who are in large part generated and sustained by human activity and human economic activity, whereas I'm also talking about a simulated construct. Both kinds of animal are alike economic products that exist for human use, but it would perhaps be naive to go the whole hog, pun intended, and argue that they are interchangeable. I do have a feel that a game like Monster Hunter has value as a kind of crude literalisation and continuation of Burgess' thought. I think it can serve to usefully defamiliarise attitudes towards animal life in an age of climate crisis brought on in significant degree by the mass exploitation and destruction of non-human creatures. Burgess' essay doesn't hold out excessive hope for the idea that the zoo animal might facilitate critique of human-animal relations, and specifically of the ways in which non-human animal bodies and subjectivities are spawned by human economic and social systems. But what if we turn our gaze to a zoo in which the Cartesian notion of the animal as a machine is to be interpreted more literally, which nonetheless strives for the impression of flesh and blood? And this is the concept I pursue in my reading of Monster Hunter today, as an idealised portrayal not only of the ways in which animals are made by humans, but also of how human subjects are articulated to themselves by much the same as economic mechanisms. So, to give you the kind of the basics, so-called basics of Monster Hunter, it takes place in this kind of island wilderness called the New World, where these large mythical creatures gather in a kind of fairly barefaced romanticising of colonialism. As a player, you are part of an army of hunters who have travelled there to explore and profit from the island's secrets. There's a traditional story you pursue through the game, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But in practice, Monster Hunter is an open-ended experience in the kind of commercial tradition of the game as a service. That's to say, it's designed to be played indefinitely in order to expose the player repeatedly to various indirect online monetization schemes. And the narrative ultimately plays second fiddle to this feedback loop of conflict, harvesting, and manufacture of equipment that is kind of designed to spin on until it ceases to earn the publisher a decent return. So you begin each play session in this area, this kind of curiously cyborgian hunter's camp made up of giant animal bones and hearts made of ship hulls, which contains facilities for making armour and weapons, and non-player characters who serve as vendors, tipsters, cooks, craftspeople and managers. One thing about them is they don't have names, they all have titles, which is interesting in light of things I'm going to say. You then, having equipped your hunter, you pick an investigation target. They're called investigations rather than hunts. From a set of kind of list of these objectives, you can then travel to this to the map depicted the area, And you can get there alone or as part of a group of players who kind of guide her over internet. And when you're in the habitat, you track down the creature, you're trying to avoid fighting, or you're trying to avoid or fight with other creatures on the way, maybe gather various kinds of resources from the landscape itself. So that's you tracking. Sorry, I'm skipping that slide. Having cornered the creature, you either fight it till it's dead or till you are able to capture it. I mean, the outcome either way is that you are able to obtain parts from its body, which can be used along with the other things you've gathered to create new weapons and armour back in the camp, and so make yourself a more effective hunter. So that's this is kind of the, on your back, as you can see I've killed something with my kind of pig type creature, and I've now turned its head into a helmet because suddenly it's dead. So, Matt Carmill writes in Hunting and Humanity in Western Thought that hunting for us is not simply a matter of killing animals. A successful hunt ends in an animal's death, but it has to be a special animal, caged, killed in a special way. It must be free, able to flee or attack the hunter. It must be killed on purpose and by violence and in person. No traps, no cages, no poison baits, no roadkills. Above all, it must be a wild animal, and what that means for the hunter is that it must be hostile, not friendly to human beings, or submissive to their authority. You can kill cows in a dairy barn, but you cannot hunt them. So, by this analysis, Monster Hunter is probably much more of a cow-killing simulator than a hunting game. The landscapes are large and lush, but they are also intrinsically rigid and predictable. They are kind of compounds, kind of gigantic theme parks, which don't really change. They're advertised to the player as kind of living, breathing ecologies, but they are designed throughout to facilitate human conquest, kind of like IKEA furniture, just kind of arrives ready for assemblage. If you pick a mission to kill a specific monster, that monster will always be present in the habitat in question. There's this kind of predictability to it, which quickly becomes kind of desensitizing. You're guaranteed certain funds, certain payouts, and certain resources for creating equipment when you kill certain beasts. And in addition to certain items you can always find in the environment in passing. And you always know in advance which pieces of which monsters you can use to make certain items, so there's never any ambiguity. So this is very much a production flow rather than a kind of, you know, sort of romanticised, mythicised process of the hunt, which, you know, there is room for uncertainty and maybe the movement of boundaries, the kind of boundary between the hunter and the quarry. You are minimally managed throughout this. The overarching narrative kind of dictates where you can go broadly and sort of broadly what you can hunt in a bid to ensure that you aren't required to hunt anything that requires much greater skill or more powerful equipment. But you're essentially free to pick the missions. You can replay those you've already completed for the sake of resources. So it's very much you're left to your own devices to kind of go through that loop of acquisition and production as many times as you like. So both the game's human participants and the non-human quarry are heavily determined by these structures, by this loop, even as the more recognisably literary elements of the game strain against them. The game casts you, in Cardinal's terms, as a living or an ambiguous figure, now a fighter against wilderness and now a half-animal participant in it, but in practice you are essentially a contemporary gig worker. You're cast into this sort of exoticised, idealised workplace simulation the gig worker role has kind of, in video games of this commercial scale generally, kind of now thoroughly subverted this older device of the player as a questing hero. I mean, there's a lot of games out there which present something like Mr. Man here, that's kind of very obviously scuttling the world, you know, with gigantic phallic metaphor in hand. But in practice, like you're doing the same things over and over again, you know, just progressively work your way up kind of an economic ladder. The game's monsters, in a similar vein, are presented to you as these tacit stand-ins for the large non-human predators that have been destroyed or absorbed or excluded by society. And that's part of this kind of strong element of ecological anxiety to Monster Hunter as a series. The series, which has run since 2004, has always sought to present you as a kind of a caretaker of species rather than an exploiter. In this game, the primary goal of the game's Hunter's Guild that you're a part of is to preserve these kind of magnificent ancient totemic beasts by culling out of control species and carrying out scientific research and punishing poachers. Except that the last two activities never really feature in the game, so it all falls over very quickly. There's no real effort to realise or further these concepts of caretaking, preservation and structure. As is often the case in video games, the narrative falls somewhere between a counterpoint to a distraction from, a fig leaf for the systems and processes that make up the moment-to-moment of play. Monsters are presented as wild beasts, but they are utterly subservient to the game's ethos of accumulation and production. They are always available to hunt. They always yield those particular raw materials on defeat. They can't be hunted to extinction, which is crucial, and their capacity for independent action within their terrain, within their territory, is, as I've touched on, very limited. They don't reproduce, though there are quests that involve collecting their eggs. And while there is talk in the game's plot of interspecies dynamics, such as predators contesting territory, they have no extensive capacity to actually change the environment in any meaningful way. Now, on the surface, Monster Hunter World might owe more to the aristocratic game preserve than, say, the factory farm, not least because it allows for the possibility that the monster might get away from you. The association is troubled, however, by the game's equipment creation system, which sees you following pre-plotted item upgrade recipes that require you to repeatedly slay or farm monsters who always leave the same raw materials behind them. So again, it's this kind of predictability. If monsters do elude you, the act of tracking them is still... That's illustrating this kind of process of... These are the bits you can get from chopping off these parts, and you know all this in advance when you go into the quest, so... if monsters do elude you, the act of tracking them is still economically productive. They use everything about Hog except the squeal, declares a tour guide in the jungle, Upton Sinclair's 1906 account of the Chicago meatpacking trade. In Monster Hunter World, even the animal's absence is useful. Its traces have value. As you explore each environment, you can inspect your quarry's spore, its traces, tracks, to generate research points, which can then be exchanged for various rewards back against town environments. So you don't even need to see it to profit from it. You just need to kind of scoop up some of its mucus or something like that. Inspecting tracks also plays into the usage of scout flies, which you can sort of see on the right of this image, it's kind of a cluster of green dots. Which are this kind of zoomorphic rendering of the navigational aids we find in many games. Given enough evidence of the creature's passage, these creatures, who kind of are always with you, kind of like a companion animal, they form this luminous path to your quarry, and the effect of this is to erase the curiosity of hunting, and essentially boil back each area's very naturalistic fixtures to these underlying abstract principles, these roots, these props, these distinctions between spaces for battle, rest, and foraging, that are the game's real governing principles. So the ceaseless operation of the scout flies ensures that while a monster may elude your clutches for a time, it has nowhere to hide. The best a monster can do is to flee the map after a preset interval, but in a majority of hunting missions, the player is free to start over till the monster is slain. That's why I pressed the button too early. These are the other kind of, scout flies are one privileged kind of animal companion in the game. The other are these creatures called the palicos. There are these AI-controlled, non-player character, kind of cat-like minions who are also sort of dress-up dolls. You equip your character and you can also buy and manufacture things for them to wear. And they come with you on missions and they occasionally help out by clobbering the monster in the face or whatever it might be. Inevitably, Bergeron argues of household pets, they serve as kind of infantilized reflections of their owners. And in this game, many players name these creatures for their cats. There's all these Reddit threads of people going, oh, it was so great to see my little Tompkins smacking the heck out of some giant dice. So, if Monster Hunter's beasts are just exotically packaged bundles of raw materials, they can be strangely sympathetic. Each beast is designed partly to suit the game's systems and spaces, but game designers also call upon frameworks from real-life beings and habitats, in the words of the game's co-director. I won't read this quote down because we've got a short time. One mark of the success of this peculiar hybridization of reference points, as you can see here, is that Monster Hunter players often struggle with feelings of empathy for creatures while stalking them. If you strike a monster somewhere that is especially vulnerable, you might stun it, you might knock it off its feet, or you might damage part of its anatomy, such as the wings or head. It's very visceral and there's a real sense of pain and injury. And if you really injure it a lot, it will actually limp away from you. And it's kind of on repetition, you realize it's always the same limb that gets dragged, which is kind of interesting in itself. But that sight is still, I think, from the perspective of many players, capable of inspiring actual remorse. Skip past these two because we're short on time. Each monster game has its portrayal of articles and community threads about the ethics of hunting, as players and reviewers struggle with the gulf between the game's celebration of the animal as an economic opportunity and its celebration of the animal as a noble wild creature. And I feel that the coincidence of this element of empathy with your awareness of each creature's place in a production process creates a tension that might further reconsideration of human-animal relations more generally. Moreover, treating in the production of animal objects within systems of behavioural reinforcement, Monster Hunter makes more obvious how the reduction of the animal is part of the same process as that by which men have been reduced to isolated, productive and consuming units, in Burgess' words. So we've had some discussion of the Skinner box, so I'll skim past the kind of the breakdown of this. But the concept of the Skinner box with its kind of habit-forming payouts has become an everyday concern in both the manipulation of human workers and the reward mechanisms of modern video games. And these two forms of conditioning have recently rejoined as this process called gamification, in which the seductive repetitions of much game design are mapped onto work, and the procedures of work are mapped back onto game design, the better to support these game as a service revenue systems that rely on the player having a long-term attachment. So I've got one paragraph left, I'm going to rush through. So that's just an example of what I was talking about, these kinds of cues. So Monster Hunter is a beneficiary of all these trends. It's saturated the cues and reward opportunities from bonus crafting materials when you log in to the chance to receive additional items by undertaking kind of piecemeal errands. But it also, I think, dredges up the history of these behavioural practices, these kind of workplace monitoring systems, by restoring animals as both the objects of aggression and part of the game's age of sort of props and incentives at the centre of the frame. And its inconsistencies, from animal machines that look back without looking, to the irreconcilability of its narrative with its system, represent a powerful critical opportunity at a time when our awareness of our various plays and capitalism scheme is badly needed. Thank you.